This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good friends. This practice is about being good friends with each other, you know? We are all good friends here in this place. I feel very honored to be here saying something. One of the things I've really been enjoying about being Shuso, the practice leader here this practice period, is that it seems like it only happens once in the life of a practicer. It's a very special time. You know, you get a chance to really, you know, find your voice. You get a chance to really work hard at something that you've, you know, I'm older now and I've had some experience in the Dharma, and during this Shuso period, I've especially devoted myself to getting up around midnight or 11 p.m. in the evening and having an opportunity to study, to just read the sutras, not commentaries on the sutras or, you know, not books on whatever I want. You know, I've had to limit myself. I've decided that I need to be able to limit myself and just work on my Shuso practice. And it's been really, really wonderful to be able to do this. And one of the things that's most striking to me, when you read one discourse of the Buddha after another, you find that he says, that the Buddha says certain kinds of things many times. And here is one that I especially like. This is from the Dhammakatiya Sutra. The Buddha stopped, looked at his best friend Ananda, and said, "Ananda, everyone commends you for studying hard and possessing a phenomenal memory, but don't think that is enough. It is important to look after the Tathagata, the Buddha, and the Sangha, but that is not enough either. Whatever time you have left, devote yourself to breaking through birth and death. Learn to look at birth and death as mere illusions, like the stars one sees in one's eyes after rubbing them for a while." This is an interesting thing here. We're not trying to make a better person. We're not. Our practice is not like going up a series of steps. You know, you get up to the top step and then you're enlightened. It's not like that. That's not our practice. So I thought today that I might try and say something about what the Dharma means to me. So, modern things. Joe knows what these are. Mm-hmm. You know what these things are?
Cactus.
This is the Dharma. The thing that you wanted, these are prickly pear cactus pads. If you know that these cactus pads contain 85 to 90% water, you can wander in a desert place and you won't need to carry water. So I wrote a little story about that this morning. The untamed desert around the tiny village of Musquis in the Mexican state of Coahuila is the end of the road. Beyond it is wilderness, el campo libre, the free land. It might appear completely inhospitable to an American city dweller, unfamiliar with the natural history and the life way of the indigenous people there. There is no water above ground. Spiny cactus and bare rock are what you see. But if you meet these people, you'll be struck by their warmth and their friendliness and childlike love of fun and getting away with wildness. What drew me to Muskies as a young speleobiologist was a rumor. Someone had heard someone mention a rumor of blind cave catfish in a stream in a cave in La Tierra Mágica del Peyote. This is the wild land where the peyote grows. In the springtime, there are beautiful pink flowers come up out of these plants in the desert. They just come up. It's so beautiful. This rumor was very vague. No one knew where the fish were. No one even knew if they still existed. No one had actually seen them. This was in the 1960s when I first visited. And you know, gasoline then was 7 cents a gallon. It's a different world, isn't it? The town, Muskies, at that time had no electricity. It was so hot outside in the summer that I would put my cast iron skillet outside and let it sit there, and when I got back from my day's work in the field, I'd crack an egg in there and it would cook itself. Didn't even have to have a camp stove or a campfire. In this little town, no one spoke English, and I spoke little Spanish, or Kickapoo, that was the native Indian language there, yet we shared the common language of being fun-loving and enthusiastic. And so as I'm trying to communicate to these people what I was doing there, they bring out salsita y saltinas, you know, hot sauce and saltine crackers. And they set them down, and they're all looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and I know something's afoot. So in spite of the dire warnings that I have had about eating the indigenous people's hot sauce, I knew something was going on, so I knew I had to do it. And so I did, and with the first taste, of course, you know, tears started pouring out of my eyes and I couldn't breathe, you know, and all these Mexicans that I'm sitting with, they're just laughing like crazy. It's just magic. And then after I pass this test, then I am welcomed into this world, you know, and then we're hanging out together, you know, and we're finding our way of communicating things about the blind fish and then, you know, rattlesnakes and stories about witches. And they said, you know, you don't go into that cave that's up there on the cliff because that's where the witches meet. And so later on in one of my visits there, I did go up into that cave. And, you feel something which is used for one thing a lot, like this zundo is used primarily for zazen. So you come here and you feel that, the energy of the nice stillness and the quiet of a zazen place. Well, this thing was, those particular witches were very bad. They were very bad. So anyway, but I went up there anyway. And these Indians, by now we're friends. So they tell me, you know, you can climb up in the mountains up there on the other side of six valleys back. There's no roads in this country. And you'll find an old well, and inside that well, you might find cave catfish inside there. So I went back through the things. And on the way, I found a group of boys, you know, dressed in little flimsy sandals, it seemed like, and, you know, just dressed real lightly, it's hot. And they were tending a big herd of goats, of several hundred goats. And they were going out to there were prickly pear cactus and bare rock everywhere around there. And they were going up and they were cutting off the pads of the prickly pears, and then they would take off the spines and then they would cut them in slices and they would eat them. And they didn't carry any water. They're just teenage boys, you know, young boys, or a group of different age boys, teenagers and younger, and they were all out in this wilderness place. But what I learned from that, you know, is when I got back into civilization, that when you know something like this, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, what it is like It's survival food. You know, it's like these prickly pears here. You know, if you know that this is, that they have that much water in them, you can go out into the desert and you can live out there. And so I would go off and, you know, just hang out in the wilderness and you know, eat prickly pear cactus. And it's a very interesting thing to know about that. In about 1982, when we were just getting Jikoji established, and there were still some of the people from Pacific High School here, and there were various different, you know, people who had, you know, were just sort of living in the woods around here, and, you know, on land which belongs to Open Space now, I found a typewritten in my notebooks. I found a typewritten thing from about that time, 1982 or so, and it was about, you know, what Koban wanted to do here at Jikoji. We wrote down on this thing, Zen life has always emphasized self-reliance, hauling water and chopping wood, and self-knowledge in terms of the forces of nature, mountains and rivers without end. This is our tradition. This is what Koban has brought to America here. We said, Jikoji's intention is to provide an opportunity for people to experience the natural world in all of its aspects, both in the stillness of the Zendo and in the surrounding valley of oaks and bay trees beside Peter's Creek and by the quiet waters of Two Moon Pond. Workshops on the natural history and ecology of the area will be offered several times a year. Koban really liked walking in the woods around here. You know, he was a little bit shorter than I am, and he was kind of a smiling man. He was very happy. You know, he was somebody that you'd look up to without having to have, you know, a rakasu or a robe on. You know, you'd watch this man walking, or you'd watch this man talking to somebody, and you'd see there was something about him which struck you, you know, like this is a real Zen master, you know, and you had a feeling for him, so that you kind of wanted to be like him. You wanted to be like that. You wanted to be recognized in that kind of a way. So as speaking as an inhabitant of this valley here, there are some things that we should know about this valley. And I've got one hidden here. There's something, you know, when you go walk in the woods around here, you know, you want to not fall down and hurt yourself like I've done. And I got a little bit cocky and I was out walking in the woods in the middle of the night and without a flashlight, just, you know, going around the woods like this, and I tripped and fell flat on my face. And it looked bloody and awful. And the next day, there's somebody who calls me her boyfriend by sign language, and this person is a gorilla. And when I went down to see her and I sat down right next to her, you know, we're 3 inches apart like this, and she comes over and says, come closer, and I come right up as close as I can to her, and she blows kisses. You know, this is a gorilla, this huge gorilla. I sit down next to her, and she's blowing kisses onto my face, and I can feel her soft breath on my face like this. And, you know, and I think she's finished, and, you know, and so then I start to move slightly back like this, and she says, like that, come closer. And she keeps on blowing, and a long time. And, you know, whenever I am with the gorilla, then I'm always with some translators, some of the people, the staff, the regular paid staff that are there. You know, and they, you know, we're supposed to keep back from her a little bit, not so we don't breathe germs on her or anything like that. But she kept, you know, they were cracking up. They just couldn't believe it. This gorilla was coming up. I mean, this is a gorilla. You know, it's coming over to me, and it's my friend. You know, she says, I love you, Eric. this is the sign language for that. You know, and she blows kisses. And in 3 days, that kiss-blown face that was all bloody is completely healed. No trace of it. So, I want to introduce someone that you may meet out here as you're walking around in the woods. And this is a rattlesnake. And one time we had an annual meeting, maybe in the mid-70s sometime, and people were, you know, worrying about rattlesnakes and what they were like and what to do with them if you meet one. And Coben and Angie, who was the director here at that time, they, here, do you know what, we can take this thing around. And so just so you can pass it around like this. And just slide it along so we won't disturb this nice rattlesnake. And, you know, and I brought in a live rattlesnake and some other snakes too, and you know, I'd get them out and everybody was holding the other snakes, and you know, I got out the rattlesnake and got it on the ground, and you know, and so everybody could see how it moves and how it doesn't move, and then I encouraged the rattlesnake to strike at me, you know, because I know the distance that rattlesnakes can strike and what they can't strike. And, you know, so everybody was able to see how the rattlesnake behaves. But this is a friend of ours, and, you know, it lives in this valley with us. And, you know, if we know about it a little bit, just like, you know, the dharma of the rattlesnake, just like, you know, the dharma of the nopales, the cactus pads, you know, then we can exist together in peace. Doug here, you all know Doug. Doug is the man who kindly ordained me as a priest. And one of the things, we have pretty much daily talks about what the duty of the shuso is, and just, you know, we talk to each other. And so I've written down something about our talks in general. You know, in the stillness of the Zendo, we meet our own nature. And when we go out the door with that nature, it is the duty of the shuso to show us how to do this, how to bring our stillness, our original nature, out the door into nature. Doug said, your duty is to show them how to walk in nature. So that's quite a thing to try to take on. Sometimes I think that one of the helpful things with walking in nature is walking like this, you know, in shashu, in this position. And you can just let your eyes go down slowly, and you can just, you know, you walk along and you see things and you hear things. And, you know, you let nature talk to you, and you may meet a tree, you may hear a tree talking to you, you know, in the same way that you might be walking along the creek and hearing the voice of Buddha speaking to you in the creek. You know, what's going on here is the real immediacy. The pure sound, the voice of the Buddha. When we had our first meeting up here at Jikoji, Coben came over to me and he said, don't turn the city into the country. Don't turn the country into the city. What does this mean? This has been something that I've thought about, you know, since 1980 or something like that, or before. You know, what did Coben mean? Why was he so specific about don't turn the country into the city? How do we turn the country into the city? We don't listen to it. Maybe that's a way of putting it. You know, when you come outside, and you just bring all of your thoughts, you know, your plans about, you know, oh, maybe I'd like to renovate my kitchen, or maybe I want to build a shed, or, you know, I have to do this or that, you know, and work involves this or that. This is all bringing the city into the country. This is all turning the country into the city. And, you know, we don't want to do that. You know, this when we were just trying to find a place to have a temple like this, we looked at lots and lots of places, but Coben was very clear to us again and again and again. He kept expressing how, pass it all the way around. If you want to see this, you know, let's you can see how its long purple tongue comes way out and then stops all the way. And then it comes back in. And it comes out. Oh, well, this is a good question. I'm glad you brought that up. Reptiles are so different than mammals. In that jar is enough air for that rattlesnake for months. When I used to be a biologist in a museum, people would bring in animals that they had for pets when they got sick, and they'd ask questions about it. And one of the quickest ways to kill a snake, for example, is to punch holes in the lid so that the snake can get air. Well, the snake senses the air, and it rubs its nose against the top of against those sharp holes on like that, and it gets an infection in its nose, and it dies very quickly. So if you find somebody with a snake in a jar like this, don't punch holes in the lid, please. A lot of snakes die that way. So maybe later on we can, you know, if we feel like it, we can go outside and I'll bring the rattlesnake out and we can, we can try to get it to bite you, or, you know, we could just look at it, or maybe we could milk it into a teacup and then pour in some boiling water and stir around the poison until it's well cooked, and then we can drink it. Rattlesnake venom tea. It's actually quite good. But something about rattlesnakes around here. You know, the rattlesnake season is coming out. You know, I'm starting to see them on rocky outcrops along the top of the ridge here now. The young ones come out first, and you know, but the ones of this size are starting to come out too. And if you don't mess with them, you probably won't get bitten. So I probably shouldn't mess with it, but nevertheless, I do. But if you should get bitten, it's kind of a fine line here. I want to scare you slightly, so you'll be careful out here, because I don't want anybody to get hurt. But I also, don't want you to be afraid also. And there's one species of rattlesnake that lives in Central California, and this is it. It's very variable. It's, you know, some individuals are green, some are black, some are pale like this one. But something you should know is that if you are bitten by a rattlesnake, even if it's 70 feet long, you probably won't die, even if you don't get medical attention. But a lot of times around here, people get bitten by a rattlesnake, and then they freak out. They jump in their car, floor it, and they go tearing on. I gotta get to the hospital. Crash. Way more people die from that than from the snake bite itself. So it's just, you know, it's just something to know about this. If you want to be really worried about something, you know, be worried about yellow jacket nests in the ground. You know, they, you know, this has been a season of a winter of very light rain, and I've already found two large underground nests, you know, on the banks of creeks. And, you know, the hole, the entrance for the yellow jackets to go in and out of their hole, of their nest, is only that size, the size of a quarter or so. And some of the nests around here will contain 2, 4, 5 million yellow jackets. And they're all female. And they all know how to protect their babies. And, you know, when I was the biologist for the Open Space District, who owns the land around us, and I'd be driving in a ranger vehicle and have the radio on, I would sometimes hear, you know, some, you know, since it, our radio band picks up state park rangers and fish and game and deputy sheriffs and all of this, and you hear about these, you know, somebody stepped on a nest in a park, and, you know, and then Stanford Life Flight helicopter comes in and takes them away. But the way that you, there's a kind, a special kind of meditation I'd like you to know about dealing with yellow jacket nests in the ground. It's called One Yellow Speck. And you train yourself with this. You're starting out in the woods right now. The nests are going to be especially large this year because some of them, the nests have overwintered, have survived through the winter, which they don't normally do. Like last winter, none survived. Is that you watch for a single yellow jacket. You know, a yellow jacket, you know, yellow jackets, they're, you know, like half an inch, as long as that, you know, and you watch for just one. And you train yourself to you catch one crosses your vision and you stop. Where did it come from? Where is it going? Here is a story how I saved my own life one time from just that. I was over the largest of the Indian archaeological sites on the Santa Cruz County coast over here is at Sandhill Bluff State Park, just north of Santa Cruz. And so I was walking in the fields over there. I was just looking around for Indian things, and then I saw one yellow jacket go in front of me. And I just stopped, and I just sensed where it was. And then a few, in a clearing, just a few feet in front of me, I saw the yellow jackets going in and out of their hole. It's that stopping. You know, you gotta stop. When you see that one yellow jacket go across, you stop. I'm not trying to scare you, but I'm trying to scare you a little bit here, so I apologize. But just practice walking around. Later on, as the spring goes along, I can show you yellow jacket nests around here in the ground, so we can get close to them, and you can see them. And here's a story about supernatural power in yellow jackets. For many years, I had a field school for nursery school age children, and I would take 8 at a time. You know, that they would stay with me for a whole year or more than 1 year. Some families would come send 2 or 3 children, and I would always be very careful, and, you know, and never got into yellow jacket nests. But one time, you know, when children have to poo in the woods, you know, then you have to hold them over the ground, you know, because they don't know how to do it themselves. So I was holding this little child, and then after the poo started coming out, then I noticed that right next to where it was a yellow jacket's nest. And the yellow jackets were all around us, but I looked at them, and I just felt, I believe in love, so I'm going to talk about love. I believe, you know, and I felt this great swirling feeling of love coming up out of my heart. And, you know, I didn't try to run away from these yellow jackets. Of course, they can outrun you easily. But I let this girl finish, and, you know, and then I picked her up, and we walked away. And the yellow jackets went on about their business, and we went on about ours. But there's something to be said about, you know, loving. It's not loving kindness, you know. It's love. It's real. It's love. You know, you just feel love for everything out here. The woods are a really magic place. And I'd like to very much encourage you to spend time outside, walking around out here, and nature has a magic of its own, and I'll give you, here's an example that I am fond of about the woods. If you stay inside the four walls, your emotions and all of your feelings, the intensity of your feelings, it goes out and it bounces back. It goes out and it bounces back. It goes out and it bounces back. And pretty soon you get so turned in on yourself that these things sweep you away, you know? And if you go out into the woods, it dissipates. And Coben and I both got married at about the same time, and we both had kids at about the same time, and so we talked about the same, you know, and I would see him at Haiku Zendo every morning for several years when I was first starting, and he told me to encourage people, you know, like the parents of children who were my students as I was their teacher, to don't keep the kids inside all day. Let them, take them outside, you know, and let them, let all this energy go out. And when Coben would get, you know, his wife was a real skillet wielder, his first wife, Harriet. And she got really mad at him sometimes, just as my wife got really mad at me sometimes and would kick us out of the house. And, you know, so Coben said, when things start to get hot like that, go outside and take a walk. Don't stay away too long, you know, but go down and go outside and take a walk and cool down. So when we come out here to the woods, the woods are a very, it has that wonderful relieving quality. You know, you open to the woods and it takes your, takes away your cares. You know, it takes away the things that you've been worried about. It takes away the intensity of things. Like, for example, you know, about 2.5 years ago, my wife of 45 years passed away in my arms. And when I talk about her, she was a wonderful nun, and Coben married us, and we met in a Zen monastery training together. And she was a city girl. She grew up in Chinatown in San Francisco. And even now, when I think about her, we were very close at the end, especially, you know, we, you know, after 40 years, you know, you've been, you know everything about another person. You've been through all the good things and all the bad things, and, you know all this kind of stuff about each other. But we said that we wanted to be best friends. One of the last words that we spoke together was that, you know, we said we want to be best friends in our next life and practice together. And when I think about Coben, when he ordained her, he gave her the name Blue Lotus. And when I think about her, you know, the feelings come up in me and I often cry. And when, you know, when I go out into the woods, I, you know, will often cry, and it's a positive kind of thing. You know, sometimes people tell me, you should get over her, go find somebody else, or, you know, they're trying to be, you know, to encourage me to get on with my life, you know, and not to be stuck in that place. But I'm not stuck in that place. It's just that we're very close, and I feel that she's with me all the time, you know. So, but when you go out to the woods, if we go out on a walk, in the walk in the woods together, you know, and I break down and cry, you know, don't think of it as being a bad thing, you know, and don't be scared by it. You know, it's that my heart is breaking open, and I'm just sharing it. You know, I'm just, you know, if I were standing in a room all the time, you know, all of these feelings would just bounce back at me. You know, so each week I set aside Wednesdays as being a day of 24-hour silence, when I will go to the most remote place there is around here, and I will just spend the day by myself, not talk to anyone. And it's very important for me. And I think about how much Koban, you know, he grew up in a small temple high in the mountains in Japan, in snow country in Japan, and he loved nature. He just loved nature. You know, we would take a walk together, and he would ask me questions about the different, you know, animals and plants and things that were around there, and you know, he just really appreciated it. And you know, it's a little bit different thing than when I first came here. After, you know, this place took me in after my wife passed away, and I was a real mess at that time. Everything was falling apart. Every morning zazen, I'd just cry and cry and cry and cry and cry, and everybody was so kind to me. You know, the Buddha Buddhism, Dharma is a really practical thing. You know, Buddha talks about the three jewels. You know, the Buddha, the awakened state, and the Dharma, you know, the teaching of the awakened ones, and the Sangha, that's us. And the love of this Sangha, who took care of me when I was so broken, it saved my life. Still saves my life. Here I am with you, and you know, we're talking about something, and you know, we're talking about something that's real. You know, when I'm just feeling like everything, this is important. I hope you. I'm trying to convey something about Koban's teaching about this place, why he wanted this place and not a city place. You know, he wanted us to come up here. He wanted us to connect with nature, our deep nature, up here, so that in such a way that the experience would go right to the roots of our mind and body, and that when we go back down into our busy, ordinary lives, that we can bring that nature that we found up here and pull it to us from even down in town. You know, we can find the nature right wherever we are. Like normally a shuso, a practice leader, chooses a Buddhist scripture to speak about, like Doug chose the Diamond Sutra to speak about, and I choose the Tree Sutra. This is a sutra without words. This is a sutra about connecting with yourself. When you look at a tree with such intensity that the boundary between you and tree completely is gone, then you are the tree and the tree is you, and you look at one tree and you see all trees in the universe. I mean, this is a very magical thing. You know, like when we just chanted about this thing in the sutra, in the Metta Sutra, when we were talking about it just now. The Metta Sutra talks about all different beings, you know, whether they're great or small, visible or invisible. You may find, especially out here in the woods, I saw it happening, and you'd see it in his eyes. You know, you'd look into his eyes and you'd see that it was going on. And when he would listen to you, he would often listen to you as I am right now, you know, with his very intensely, with his eyes closed, you know, during the Shuso ceremony, which we're going to have in a few weeks here. You know, he would sit in the back of the Zendo, and you could just feel his concentration. So when in the Metta Sutra, it talks about beings visible or invisible. So when I said to you, good friends, you know, I am it felt like at that moment, both visible and invisible friends were here in this room. Sometimes when you sit long enough in this room, that you feel the presence. You know, like I always feel Koban up there in that thing. You know, he's in that corner of the room. Wherever I am, you know, sometimes I just get a thought of him, you know, and it's you know, it's always from that place. I guess he likes to hang out there, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I miss Koban. You know, he was my good friend. He is my good friend. You know, when I would ask him things about the sutras, like the Metta Sutra, you say, you know, what is this about visible or invisible, you know, great or small or near and far, born or yet to be born. You know, all of these things are within our perception. You know, when you sit quietly long enough in some wonderful place, and like here in the valley, like going and sitting over at Koban Shrine across the creek, across the bridge. Have you all been there to that place? You know that place? You should go and say, you know, introduce yourself to Koban. You know, tell him something about your experience of Jikoji or something. Talk to him about your practice. You know, something that I call it whispering time. And you know, I take this to my gorilla friend Coco. You want to see a picture of my girlfriend? Where is she?
Under the rock. There too.
Oh. This is a picture of Coco. You know, she's a huge black gorilla. And she's really, really sweet. And you know, this little gray kitten that's with her, her name is Miss Gray. And Coco is quite a good Zen teacher, you know? Like one day I came into Coco and I were whispering together. I like to go in and whisper to her like I whisper to Coco, you know, I just, you know, very softly so that nobody else can hear, just me and Coco sitting there, and I whisper, and I just tell her whatever comes to my mind. It's like having a private meeting with a Zen teacher, like I had yesterday with Angie, you know, and you just, you know, and you just tell her, you just let the words come out, you just let it flow out like that, and you whisper, and you see that, you know, normally when you're looking to somebody, you know, you see their eyes, you know, they might shift around as different thoughts come through their eyes and through their mind, and you know, but with Coco and me, when we're really close like that, you know, our eyes are just that far apart, and we're looking in each other's eyes, and we're just whispering nice like this, so that nobody else can hear us. And I tell her all the secrets of the world, and she loves it. And all the and the interesting thing is that sometimes I tell her jokes, and you know, I'm just very intense on her eyes. I'm telling her jokes, and the translators, you know, there are people who have to, you know, Coco's a, you know, kind of like a celebrity, you know, international celebrity, and so they take really, really good care of her. And so these people who are sitting behind me, and they're watching, you know, and sometimes they'll tell me, you know, Eric, Penny just called us up on the telephone and said, Eric, put your surgical mask on again, because it falls down sometimes when I'm talking to Coco for a long time. And you know, so that I put it back up. But then you see that her absolute attention is completely unwavering. You know, like you're really sitting and you're really into it, and you're not, you know, you're just right on the dot. And so one day there was a chair. I don't like to sit on a chair when I go to talk to Coco or do zazen with her. I just sit on the floor. And so the empty chair that's to my right is always there. And so then Miss Gray comes in, and she comes up on the and sits on this table behind me. And you know, I reach back to just, you know, give her a little acknowledgement pet that she's there. And then Coco calls me over, and then the translators, Sophia, who is so fluent in sign, she says, Coco says she doesn't want you to pay attention to anyone else when you're with her. She wants your whole undivided attention. You know, so you can think of her as being a, you know, friend. You know, you're with a friend, and you don't want to be, you know, have all these distractions going on. And you know, so when we go outside of the Zendo, you know, we've been having this one-on-one meeting with our gorilla, our stillness, our deep self, and we try to take it out the door with us. We try not to let it. We don't just drop it and leave it here in the Zendo, but we want to take it out the door, and we want to connect with things outside. We want to connect with everything. You know, opening to everything. This is the meditation posture of, you know, that's usually called Kinhin walking meditation. It actually, it's a very interesting thing, let me tell you. When I was training at Tassajara, during practice period, the Shuso at that time, he was a very flamboyant teacher, Bill Kwong. And he would put, you know, he'd take a step, you know, and he'd put the heel of his foot down, and then very gradually put the rest of his toe down like that, and then he'd lift up the heel of his other foot, and so that it was a constant motion of, you know, his feet were always, you know, they're moving like this. There was no stop for stillness. And I came back to Haiku Zendo, and the first day that I got back on winter break, and Koban immediately came up to me and corrected me. He said, when you are doing walking meditation, you put your whole foot touches down at the same time. It's not front first and then back. It's not back first and then front. Your whole foot goes down, and then you stop. It's a complete stop. Your body and your mind have to completely stop. And I said, but Koban, the Shuso at Tassajara, you know, this, he did it like this. And Koban said, I will speak to him about that. So this is an interesting, you know, thing about how to do this walking meditation. I suppose there are very, very different ways of doing it. But, you know, this is how Koban taught me. So I would like to share this with you. You know, it's very, very slow. You know, when your breath starts to come in, you move 1 foot half a step forward and set it down completely at one time. And then there's a period of stopping, complete stopping. You don't move your body or your mind. And then the breath goes in, and you do it the same thing again. So that there's a period of, you know, there's a brief period of motion, and then there's a longer period of stopping. So it's actually Buddha walk could actually, maybe better, should be called Buddha stop. And you know, here in this beautiful valley, when I track wild animals, when I track deer or when I track mountain lions, I follow them and I go along at a particular pace, and what they seem to do is that they know exactly where I am. All the animals know exactly where I am. They go a circle around behind me and then they appear behind me. They're just curious. This is just the way they do things. But and then they're waiting there like that. But all the animals, they're know exactly where I'm going as I'm going through the woods. And then all of a sudden I stop. And they can't stand it. And then it brings them out of hiding. I mean, it's like they get into the tone of the pace of my walking along, and then all of a sudden I stop and they come out of hiding. And so in that case, the wild animals themselves are symbolic of insights. You know, you can't have insights unless you have stopping first. That's the, you know, our Zazen meditation is, you know, is the two kinds of Buddhist meditation are shamatha, which is stopping or calming or calm abiding meditation, and insight meditation. And ours, the Zazen practice that we have, is kind of between those two. But you can't have insights unless you first have the stop. So, like one time I asked Koban about enlightenment. I've been thinking a lot about that lately. And I asked him, I said, do people usually attain enlightenment when they're in their Zazen? And he said, no, they don't. He said, much more commonly, people, they stand up from their chair, and there's a stop that comes right like this. And once you start to see these stops in your world, you'll find them all over the place. You know, like I was watching Doug the other day working on his computer, and he would you know, he'd do something and then he'd stop, and he'd do something and then he'd stop. And it's in that stop space. You know, you get up this far from your sitting practice, then enlightenment is there. You get up all the way to the top, and you're just about to bow. Enlightenment is right there. So you're to be aware of that. You know, as you walk in the woods, you take one step, and then you stop all the way, and something gets divulged. You see something right there. You see it, things just as they are. Oh, I guess I've been talking too long, haven't I? Do you have, I know in our practice we should have some discussion and questions and things like that. So you know, I'll shut up. And if there's anything you are interested in, please ask me. Yes.
What did you mean that the dharma was there in the cactus pads?
The if you are in the desert and you are lost, if you know that these cactus pads are almost all water, you'll be able to survive there. The Dharma is about is like survival food. If you know what the Dharma is, you can't just sit. You have to also understand the Dharma. You know, the Buddha tells us all different kinds of things about things as it is. He will tell us, watch out for this, you know, or he will tell us, he will caution us, you know, he will point out something that is a mistake. And in his, you know, you read widely in the scriptures, and if you concentrate only on the actual scriptures, the actual sutras, the actual words that the Buddha said, not on commentaries or anything like that, you'll find that there are patterns to what he says, and you'll find many things in your own life. You know, like he'll say, do it this way, not that way. Or he will say, everything, you know, everything in your whole life, you know. He'll say, you know, if you can't sit full lotus, you know, then sit seiza, like I sit, like that. It's a much more flexible position. You can sit much more comfortably. You know, when I was first sitting, I'd really tried to sit half lotus and then full lotus, and Koban was encouraging me to do it, but I would just shake to pieces and cry. And, you know, so Koban suggested that I do this, sit in this much more flexible position. I still shake and I still cry sometimes, but, you know, I also can sit for longer periods, and, you know, especially, you know, now that I where I live in the woods over there across the creek, I do a lot of times, you know, sit all night. And, you know, I just find that it's, you know, it's just, you know, when you're out in nature, you can just do this kind of thing. You know, these things, you know, all the concerns and stuff that's going on in the world, it's quiet. There's nothing going on. There's no people around. There's no human sounds at all. You know, you may hear the soft sound of a fox walking past the hut when you're just sitting quietly in the night. Well, I heard the bell, so I guess we're all hungry, starving to death. Oh, yeah, we can't starve to death. We've got cactus pads.